Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of The Case Podcast, another conversation about software engineering. My name is Stefan Tilkoff, and today my guest is Artur Ortega. Artur, I'm very pleased to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for the invite, Stefan.
Our topic today is going to be a lot of fun. I'm very sure of that, because we will be talking about REST versus GraphQL. And if you've ever heard me speak about REST, then you know that I'm a big fan of this. So in the same spirit as with the episode with Markus Völter, this is going to be one of the controversial ones. And I actually like them a lot, because they give me a chance to learn a lot. And Artur liked the one with Markus, so that's why he volunteered and tried to pick a topic that he was sure would annoy me. Is that a fair summary, Artur?
Yeah, that's a very fair summary.
Well, okay, so please do start by telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yes, my name is Artur Ortega. I live in London since 2007. I'm a software architect. At the moment, I'm working for a digital health startup, and I'm heading off there the platform architecture.
Okay. And one of the topics you're dealing with right now is GraphQL.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that what we should start with is a REST intro, and then weirdly enough, you asked me to do it. So this is a little strange for our format, so I will be doing stuff first. So I will be doing a brief REST intro, and then we will continue by the GraphQL criticism, maybe by a brief GraphQL intro first, and then address some of the criticism that GraphQL folks have of the REST paradigm. Okay, so I will try to be very brief, and that is really hard for me. Probably by now everybody has heard something about REST and has some idea what that is. So I will try to summarize this very briefly. REST stands for a representational state transfer, not that that matters in any way. And it's the title of a PhD thesis written 20 years ago by Roy Fielding, who is one of the people who was very influential in standardizing the web, mostly the HTTP protocol, but also quite a few other standards, RFCs around core web architecture protocols and formats. And the REST architectural style is called an architectural style because it is sort of a little bit of scientific approach to classify a certain kind of system, namely the web. So what REST tries to do is it tries to summarize a few key decisions in the design of the architecture of the web, and then explain what kinds of benefits you might derive if you apply those decisions, if you stick to those restrictions. And then it gives that thing a name. So it starts by, you know, talking about a bit about different styles that you might want to use, something like whatever, pipes and filters or client server, and it derives this particular style that makes up the web. So REST is not, as many think, a web API specification or a style to, you know, compete with SOAP and WSTL web services. It essentially is the architecture or the architectural style underlying the architecture of the web. And with that out of the way, the core idea here is that there are things that have an identification on the web. That's a URI or URL, if you prefer. So there are identifiable things. You interact with those things. And the way you interact with those things is by means of hypermedia. So hypermedia, as in hypermedia, H in HTTP, or hypertext in that case. The hypermedia idea is essentially that whatever you do is based on what you got from your communication partner before. So if you consider a web application, standard classical web application, what happens is you retrieve something from some URI, a representation of that resource identified by that URI, and that might include a few links to other things. And if you follow a link, you retrieve another representation. And then that might include maybe a form, and then you add some input into one of those forms, and then you submit the form and get back a new representation, and so on and so on. So you navigate through the state of your system by following links and using other hypermedia affordances. And that core idea is the same whether you're using a browser as a human being or whether you're writing an API client that does that by, you know, using the same mechanisms automatically. And that, in turn, gives you some benefits. That's the core idea. If you do that, you get a very, very decoupled system, or a very loosely coupled system. And that is evidenced by the fact that we use it every day to navigate sites, jump from Twitter to some other site, go to Facebook, and interact with lots of different applications written by different people all over the world. So it scales pretty well, and it fulfills that promise of being decoupled. And that is my attempt at a brief summary of what REST is about.
That sounds really good.
Brief enough?
It's really good, and it gives me a good segue to GraphQL.
Oh, perfect. Because, so please go ahead and explain what GraphQL is then.
Okay, GraphQL was defined a few years ago, probably 5 years ago, by Facebook as a blueprint. Later on, evolved and implemented by several other teams and different languages and so on. I think the most famous now is at the moment Apollo, but GraphQL itself basically exists now as a standard. And the idea is there to look at REST and to say, okay, is there a better way of navigating one entity to the other, like we described at the moment, and following hypermedia references? And at the beginning, people were using it a little bit like a smart proxy, because in the end, people wanted to have not just one REST endpoint. They were usually interested into the data sitting behind the hypermedia references, and usually they were looking into optimizing the data fetching when you are using the API. So they didn't want to overfetch the data, feel that they are not interested in, and they didn't want to issue additional HTTP requests to fetch additional data that were sitting behind the hypermedia references. And this standard comes with a strongly typed schema definition, very data-centric, and takes this navigation from REST to the next level by specifying a data model and specifying the references to other objects or to itself, so that you would be able to explore the schema and navigate the schema. But the interesting part with the navigation is that you are navigating by cherry picking nested data. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest difference to REST. So more data centric, a clear schema, which in REST probably you would defer to Swagger or other tools to define, or JSON schema to define your REST, but it's not as standardized. GraphQL standardizes that. It is a very, very strongly typed way of specifying your data and the references between them, and it optimizes the query of the data.
Mm-hmm.
That's in essence basically GraphQL.
Okay. So maybe we can try to sort of separate some issues here, right? One is the criticism that I often read when I see people introducing GraphQL. You actually didn't do that very much, right? Which I sort of suspected that you wouldn't be doing that. But the many people who introduce GraphQL use the first two pages of their article to bash REST. So there is this implied criticism that something is wrong with REST and bad about REST, and we can address that as one topic. Then mm-hmm. there's another thing, which is simply a description about or of what GraphQL actually is. And I think mm-hmm. we should make a clear separation there, because while it's fun to disagree about, you know, the criticism of REST or not, mm-hmm. it's also interesting to simply know what GraphQL is, independent of whether you think the criticism of REST is justified or not. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can separate the two. And let's spend a bit on the fun part before we dive into the actual technical description. And then maybe later on we can revisit the criticism mm-hmm. again in a sort of a more informed way.
Let's talk about the pain point that you would have with REST. Okay.
Yes, please.
So one I touched slightly in the definition was overfetching. So what do you do if you have a mobile device, low bandwidth, and you want to interact with REST? The provider of the REST API usually doesn't have only one customer or one use case, and needs to find the common nominator or the superset of the fields that someone needs. And this means that you have to provide basically the full data to the client or create bespoke BFF backend for four front-end endpoints for particular customers. It's
I
one
disagree with
criticism
that
on REST.
assessment. So
Okay.
that is the starting. That's one of the things that drives me crazy about this discussion,
Okay.
then. And that is that I think many people who criticize REST are not really criticizing REST. What they're criticizing are bad HTTP APIs. And I have no problem accepting that GraphQL is a vast improvement over bad HTTP APIs. I just I'm reluctant to call them REST APIs because that's not what they are, right? I think many people have, well, let me try this from a historical perspective. When this thing
Yes.
started out, initially people had zero respect for HTTP at all. It was, first of all, they decided not to use it at all. And then they decided, okay, this thing seems to be taking off and people seem to want to use it, so let's use it in some way. And then things like SOAP got invented, which essentially tunneled everything through HTTP POST, or these horrible HTTP query APIs got invented that, even worse, tunneled everything through HTTP GET. And that was not only no respect for HTTP, that was basically disrespect of HTTP. It was like actively ignoring everything about the thing. And we've moved quite a bit from that stage to a stage where GraphQL people, as well as REST people, as well as whatever you call the HTTP, JSON people, whatever, they all acknowledge that HTTP has some benefits. And some of those benefits include caching and the meaning of the HTTP verbs and headers and stuff. So most people have moved to at least something like a CRUD HTTP API, right? Where GET, PUT, POST, DELETE are used roughly mapped to the create, read, update, delete verbs known in database programming. And they've created APIs that do a little better in respecting HTTP. But they're not REST APIs, because a REST API is not something that you use to write an application. A REST API, if it's supposed to be a REST API, actually is an application. It's supposed to sit on a different layer, right? If you have an HTTP API, if you expose an HTTP API to the outside world, that in a visualization of layers is too low, right? Too close to the database, then you will be required to write a client that has a lot of business logic. And HTTP and, or let me rephrase, REST APIs are really not about that. A REST API is supposed to encapsulate a lot of business logic. So say you have an approval process or something, then a REST API is excellent to expose that approval process to the outside world. It's not a good candidate to expose a low-level API that somebody else can use to write an approval process. That's, it just sits at the wrong layer. So if you compare GraphQL to a low-level HTTP API, what I would consider a bad REST API, then that criticism holds. But if you write, that's essentially the short version of what I just ranted about. If you write a good REST API, then it'll have the information needed to go to the next step, regardless of what kind of client it is that you're using there. Because essentially, they'll all have the same requirements in terms of the business logic on the server side they want to reuse. Does
Yeah,
that make sense?
it makes sense, but I think GraphQL goes a little bit, well, it splits the work up a little bit. So you don't have only queries in GraphQL, you have mutations as well.
We'll get to
And
that.
so you would basically the use case that you'd explained about an approval process would go through the mutation, and there's a standardization there as well on if you provide the ID back, you can provide the client with all the fields that have been updated through your approval process. And so you have like a strongly consistent way of returning the data that has changed on that object that you basically change the status
I
and would get
understand
basically
that.
back on the client. So it's a slightly different, it wouldn't be the query path. The query path would more about like navigating the data and querying the data itself.
Okay, I think we'll get into more detail about that. And that is a valid thing, right? Because what you're saying now is that you could essentially achieve the same, you could sort of put the API at the same level, at the same layer with both, right? Mm-hmm. But you would have just you would have the benefit of standardization with the GraphQL approach. We can discuss that. But that is a different one than saying the REST API will be too low level and too chatty, because that always drives me crazy. That is sort of the standard argument that I always read for people trying to sell me GraphQL. If they want to sell me GraphQL by telling me REST sucks, and then I look at the way they use REST and I agree it sucks because it's not REST what you're doing there, right? If you use it at a different level, you wouldn't have the problem. That's maybe just a way of selling it, right? Maybe it works.
Yeah.
So that's perfectly fine. If it works for selling GraphQL to people who have bad experience with a RESTful approach, okay. Mm-hmm. Doesn't work for me because I don't have that bad experience with those things. And maybe it sort of alienates me for no good reason. It makes me criticize GraphQL simply because of the way it's sold to me as opposed to its technical benefits.
Let's take the advantage you were explaining about having media references.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, for example, I work in digital health, so there would be, for example, an appointment. The appointment would have a hypermedia reference to the patient, a hypermedia reference to the location where the appointment is, a hypermedia reference for the practitioner who is taking care of the consultation. And if you go for REST, you would basically fetch the appointment and see what is... When is the appointment? When does it start? When does it end? And in the moment, you would like to know who is taking part at the appointment, where is the appointment, you would need to follow these hypermedia references. So the example that you gave is like the web. You would follow them if you are interested into them.
Again, sorry for interrupting you. I'm not sure I agree, right? Which is say, or no. Please finish first, then I'll see whether I disagree or
not. So the idea would be now to say, okay, we are defining these entities like an appointment, a patient, a practitioner, a location as their own separate resources or entities. And we live with these references. And what you would basically do when you are navigating it with GraphQL, you would get the definition for your appointment, but while following the hypermedia reference, you would get as well the definition for the nested entities, like a patient, practitioner, and a location, and you would be able to cherry-pick some of the values that you need there. And the interesting part is then you get all the fields that you need in one way back without looking at the hypermedia reference themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They are basically transparent to the moment. So in the moment you go to the appointment, say, give me the appointment with the patient name, consultant name, and the location name, you would get these three additional values to your appointment object back without the need of looking at the hypermedia reference themselves. They are just like pointers in C. You're not interested in the pointer, you're just interested into the values they are referencing at.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is basically a big difference, I think, to REST, I think.
Okay. So... I mostly disagree with that assessment as well. So one of the things is that you sort of implicitly introduced you could call it a normalization step there, right? You said, well, in a REST world, you would have the appointment and then you would point to, you know, the doctor or the patient and the medication, I don't know, sort of implying that if I were to design this system in a RESTful way, I would be decomposing things on this fine grain level.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I have absolutely no incentive to do that if that's not what the use cases ask for. If you go to a website, let's say you buy stuff at Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk, then you're not presented with this kind of interface. You're not presented with something that only has some information about one entity. And every time you want something, some additional information, you have to navigate to another one, and you don't have to follow 100 links to assemble the information you need to make a purchasing decision. That's not the way a website works. The way a website works is it presents you with everything you need to take the next step, whatever that is. Maybe click a link or submit some data. And a good REST API would follow the same principle. It would give you whatever you need now, and it would possibly give you ways to drill down to more detail, but only if you need it. So... let's say your use case is, in your domain, I don't know, making an appointment, maybe canceling an appointment, right? To cancel an appointment, I need to know whether I found the right appointment. And maybe I need an option to not cancel, but reschedule it. Or maybe I can ask whether it's still possible to cancel it, or I can get some information about what the cost would be if I canceled it now. Then that information would all be presented to me along with the next possible steps that I can do, like cancel it with a reason, or cancel the cancellation, whatever it is. So in a good restful system, whether it's an API or a website or a web app, you would be presented with the information, with the contextual information that you need to make the next decision of how to move the thing forward. Now, what I do grant you is that there is a difference in who gets to decide what that is, right? Because in the restful model, it's the server that decides that. That's essentially, to me, that is what the client-server system in that case means, right? The server decides that and presents those options, which has both benefits and downsides. So one of the benefits is that it's consistent across all clients. I now have the same, you know, the same information. This is the kind of information that I need to present my users, my clients, my consumers, if they need to take that next step. And maybe I have variants of that. I have, like, you know, these three or four paths through the stages in my system with maybe different stuff, but it's sort of predefined on the server side. It's sort of, I determine on the server side with the benefit that it's consistent, and the downside that I can't deviate from that. If you as a client are just interested in just one particular aspect, you might get too much data or too little data. And with GraphQL, you can influence that.
It has an influence as well on the architecture on the server side. Because the example now with the appointments, and you would say, I actually, if I do an appointment, I would provide you the data of the patient name, practitioner name, and location name, because I know you need it. But practically, this data in a big enterprise would sit in different places, and there are probably even other REST APIs maintained by other teams. So where it ends up is that on the server side, the responsible for the appointment need to understand how the patient data works, how the practitioner data works, how the location data works, need to deal with probably sub requests into them or subscribing to events to get the data into their domain. But in the end, they need to understand the patient, the practitioner, and the location. There are three foreign resources to the appointment. They need to understand them to provide you with information. GraphQL gives you, let's say, a different architecture for that, because you leave the fetching of the nested data to the GraphQL service itself by just referencing it. That means the appointment team doesn't need to know how a patient works, doesn't need to know the data model, and doesn't need to fetch the data. So they don't have to deal with additional sub-requests, what to do when the data is missing, how the retries, or even subscribing to data to basically put it into the data model.
But that sounds a bit like, you know, if I were to write an application that has a user interface, it sounds a bit like, I would say, well, I don't have to understand this data and that data and that data, because I simply just give my user a SQL query panel where they can enter a SQL query and they get the raw data. I mean, of course, that's true. They got the raw data, but I haven't really solved a problem. I've just delegated the problem to somebody else, namely the user, or in your case, the client, because now the client will need to understand the data, right? As opposed to the server. Somebody has to understand it to make sense of it.
But they still have to understand it even if you provide them the API. So the interesting part with GraphQL is this strongly typed data schema, or the GraphQL schema. That means you can inspect the schema and you get the full schema in one go. So the whole API that you're getting basically becomes one domain. It's not like an API gateway where you would have several REST APIs on it and you need to figure out how the one works and the other. If you just would follow Hypermedia reference and you leave it to the client, on that case, you get the full data model for an appointment, and that would include the data model for the patient and so on. So you still have to understand it regardless if you make it part of the appointment on the REST API, or you basically get a GraphQL schema.
I agree to a certain degree. So I don't, I will not, you know, argue that schemas don't have value. Mm-hmm. I think they have downsides as well, but they do definitely mm-hmm. have value. So maybe now is a good point to really go into more detail about the GraphQL aspects. So mm-hmm. why don't you start us off with a little more of a technical introduction to GraphQL. How does it work? What features does it provide?
Okay, so central to GraphQL is our GraphQL schema. This is a standardized way of defining your data model. And additional to the data model itself, where you define them through different entities, you have a standardization as well about pagination and some of basically our best practices as well. So Facebook that basically is specified about how you basically filter on this pagination and how you name basically things. So you have a particular kind of style guide for these data schemas, how you define them. And then an additional part is you can annotate these schemas. They're called directives. Or you can even define custom directives where you define for each of the fields basically some specifics about that field. And it could be, for example, visibility for a particular role, or you want to apply basically additional polymorphic options for that field. And the schema itself basically is basically a combination of different entities that are referencing each other. The other part, and that goes a little bit beyond of the just using GraphQL just basically to reference the schema, would be as well the how to navigate a graph. And that would mean, for example, if you think about pagination, it would be the reverse search or the adjacency list. So in the mm-hmm. case, for example, I gave, an appointment references a patient. The patient itself doesn't reference the appointment, but the reverse search would be a list of appointments. So you would basically define, for example, as part of the patient definition, the list of appointments. That would be all the appointments that are belonging to that patient. And then you would basically act on that list of appointments. So you get basically a sense of a graph by navigating in one direction and having the pagination on the adjacency list. Mm-hmm. And that gives you basically a different semantics about navigating the data itself. Then that, and under the hood, basically, to each entity, each field itself needs its own resolver. These resolvers can be bespoke code. Under the hood, these resolvers could even end up to go to several backend services. Even basically, you are fetching a patient, but the patient data would come from different services. Because you are resolving it field by field, you would basically be able to resolve it even from different resources. Mm-hmm. The other part is you can annotate as well these fields with directives to specify which fields are being deprecated. And then the other part is because GraphQL itself doesn't allow to say, give me the full piece of data and all the fields, but you always have to specify implicitly, explicitly the field that you are interested in. It gives the server side the option to know which fields are actually being used by the client. And you know if you are breaking something, if you are deprecating a field or adding a new field, which allows a complete new evolution of the API without versioning, but gradually moving fields along.
Mm-hmm. So let me see whether I've understood this correctly. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what you've just described is I have a data modeling language mm-hmm. that allows me to specify the entities that make up my context or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. With all their fields and types and the relation mm-hmm. between those entities and some meta information about mm-hmm. all of the fields and entities like deprecation or maybe some information about validation rules or whatever it is. That would be something that is sort of the well, I don't know what the GraphQL people call it, the contract, right? But it's sort of
the GraphQL schema.
Okay, so it's the schema. It's the in the WSDL times we would have called it, you know, the a contract first design. Doesn't really matter. So you basically design this schema so that you have an agreement between the users of that schema and the providers of that schema.
Mm-hmm.
So from the user side, if I am a GraphQL user, I can retrieve that schema from some place, can look at it, and then I can start to actually do something with the other side without knowing what's behind that particular schema,
correct,
how it's fulfilled, how it's provided. Okay.
Correct.
So from the client side of things, what are the things that I can do with that schema?
Okay. So the interesting part with this schema, because you can basically inspect the schema that is standardized, that means you can use interactive GraphQL clients. There are several of them. Graphical is one of them. Playground, there are several of them which explore the schema of an API. They get the documentation that is annotated to it. If they know basically the types that you can specify, and that means you can start to explore the API. Very often, providers of an API would even provide predefined queries for that API, but in the end, you would have an interactive tool with auto-completion where you could start to query the data in an interactive way.
A bit like a SQL query builder for
like database, a workbench. Right? Yes, exactly that.
But you're working with live data.
Mm-hmm. it's interesting because you're not. You have it, otherwise you would go from a REST definition and you need to read the documentation or read the Swagger documentation to understand your API. This one is more like an explorative way to doing that and making use that JSON is as readable as it is.
Let me just make a brief note of the fact that I don't consider Swagger to be RESTful or a good example of something. But okay. Okay, understood. So I use, for example, an interactive client. I don't have to do that, but I can do that to explore the schema and figure out what it is that I want and how to get that and maybe fiddle around with some actions. So you mentioned that it's not just queries. I think everybody can
sort
of guess that there are queries, but there are also other options.
Yes, right? There are two additional ways of interacting with GraphQL. The next one is mutation. Which includes create, update, and delete. This is probably the most equivalent that you were explaining. The interesting part with mutations and a lot of the clients for this standard basically very often use local caches, local copies of the data. And that means that you can be, when you are mutating the data, you can basically return for the ID that has changed or the affected data back so that the client itself can update the local copy. Mm-hmm. Where often, usually what happens is otherwise you would update a piece of data, you would get some additional information back how to continue with your journey, and there could be another query, for example. And this is slightly different. And
sorry,
it's very aligned with CQRS probably, where you do the command layer with the nice advantage that you would get the effect of your command basically immediately back if you want to come back empty as well. But the recommended would be that you come back with basically what was the effect of your command. And then the query would be a separate password. It's very close to what you basically would say could suggest. Then the other part is subscriptions. There are different implementations of them. Some of them are webhooks. So you are mutating something. It has an impact. And then you want to subscribe to some of the data that you have locally if they have been updated. Mm-hmm. So some of them are defined, basically can be implemented with webhooks or with WebSockets. A lot of the implementations use WebSockets to keep your data locally up to date.
Mm-hmm.
So for the data basically that you have basically impacted.
Okay, so the typical model here would be a local application, let's say a native application running on some device, or maybe a single page application, whatever it is, something that has logic, has its own local copy of the data relevant to its scope, right? Like maybe the users it's interested in or the transactions it's interested in. It would send commands to the GraphQL site to get stuff mutated. It would get back the results if they're relevant for something they're subscribed to because they're interested in that, and then they would update their local copy. So it's essentially, and that is, I think, a perfectly valid and absolutely a reasonable discussion, because what we're describing here is a certain architecture, and that's the architecture that GraphQL is built for, right? My only argument that I'm probably going to come back to multiple times during the rest of our talk is that this is specifically not something you would ever aim for with a RESTful system, right? So the whole comparison is maybe broken. But let's continue because I'm just learning so much at the moment. I'm having fun doing that. Okay, so I understood the client side. Yep. I have standard ways of interacting with that thing. I would just assume I don't have to worry about anything implementation-wise on the server side, because I have standardized interaction with everything that exposes this kind of GraphQL schema. So in terms of the standardization, is there one GraphQL standard in one particular version that's current, or what is the status there?
There's a working group on GraphQL that are working on the standard. Usually the fundamental part is no breaking changes. That is as well how you basically evolve as well your schema yourself. And it's a lot of tooling around that additionally to that. So you would have toolings around what are the queries you are getting in, can you double check if the changes you are having basically have an impact on other clients. It could be other services as well that you are using, and basically most of the time is evolving an API without breaking change. And the same is for the schema as well. There are more and more basically directives being added that over the time that are evolving, like date and time, these kind of things. But at the same time, you can extend it yourself with a custom directive and so on. But otherwise, it's basically it's clearly defined and standardized for that.
Okay, so I'm just asking this because for other standards, you sometimes have some people call something a standard, but in actual real life, it's not that interoperable at all. That is not the case in this.
You can basically use a Java client and a Python server for GraphQL, or a TypeScript client and a Scala server. It wouldn't make any difference at all.
Okay, perfectly fine. Okay, so I think we've covered most of the client side view, right? Or is there something missing?
Yes, I think we have probably to come back as well. Why it became so popular, because you mentioned basically badly implemented REST APIs. So GraphQL became mostly popular by the front-end developers and mobile developers. It was basically tired of dealing with probably bad designed REST APIs. And on the same time, especially on mobile, where they wanted to make sure that the number of connections to the server are optimized. That was in the time 5 years ago, that was basically HTTP2 wasn't a thing yet on the CDN level. So you still speak about HTTP 1.1. If it's HTTPS, each connection would need to basically do the handshake and the SSL certificates and so on. So each connection on a mobile phone was having a lot of impact on how fast you can interact with the REST APIs on the server side. And they were trying to optimize the connections to have one connection and leaving it to the server side to do all the steps necessary to deal with REST APIs. And that's usually where GraphQL came in. So usually you had front-end developers, mobile developers, they were saying, we don't want to deal with, you would say, bad implemented REST APIs, but that's basically how the reality looks like. And they were saying, let's simplify the interaction with the REST APIs. Let's simplify the interaction with hypermedia references. And mm-hmm. let's move the complexity to the server side so that on the client side, I can have a very lightweight UI and dealing with just with local state and local copies, but minimizing the business logic on the client.
That makes perfect sense.
Usually where it starts.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, and I don't even disagree. Right? If we can settle on the fact that these, you know, that we're having these badly designed REST APIs for whatever reason. Maybe it's because mm-hmm. REST is so hard. Maybe it's because people did a bad job. Who cares? Mm-hmm. We had that situation, and it's definitely not something that I would deny that this exists. There are tons of really really bad REST APIs. It's just the question of what strategy do we use to fix that situation. And of course, I would argue that the best way would be to fix the bad APIs and make them good APIs, thereby sort of reducing the need for something like GraphQL. But I mean, maybe that's just a wish. Yeah, maybe that's just wishful thinking. And then the other option, of course, is to invent something that can make more sense of that or make it easier for people who design bad REST APIs to design, well, maybe not good REST APIs, but at least good GraphQL schemas. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a good strategy. And mm-hmm. if you assume that that is the case, then the rest of what we just discussed makes perfect sense. So I have no disagreement mm-hmm. on the technical side of things. We can have a debate about what the better architecture is for what scenario, but let's move that to the end.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, I now have a pretty good picture of what GraphQL does on the client side. So maybe let's move to the server, to mm-hmm. the implementation side yeah. of things. I have this thing and now I'm responsible for implementing that yeah. schema, that contract. How do I do that?
Okay, so usually people define the schema and then they start to implement the resolvers for each of the fields.
So please explain that again to me. I do need a resolver for each of the fields. That puzzled me.
Yes, usually it's basically if it's basically a one-to-one mapping, it's not a big deal. Very often, and we're speaking about the front end trying to simplify some of the work that they have to do, that means usually they implement resolvers for the fields you're exposing, and these resolvers could fetch the data from a database, from a REST API, from any kind of different sources, but they are unifying and making the data consistent, even if they are usually sitting in different endpoints on the server side. And usually you are implementing, in that case, resolvers for each of the fields. And you are very, very, very local to each of the fields when you're implementing GraphQL. And that's a big difference to probably classical REST APIs where you're not as specific on a field level.
Hmm.
And at the beginning, and that's the interesting part, is at the beginning, they're using it a little bit like a smart proxy, where they can say, can you pick these fields from these two different endpoints and make it consistent to me and make sure that the data type is the right one? And mm-hmm. and deal with the case if some of the APIs don't respond at all. So, for example, how to deal with partial responses if some of the REST APIs are not there. How to store the data, which of the fields you would basically make nullable to say basically that there's no data coming back. And mm-hmm. and you can still deal with partial updates even if the server side is not completely available. And it all goes down to the level of writing this resolver. It's the first encounter usually you see basically GraphQL just as a smart proxy and not as a graph data modeling tool on its own right. That's mm-hmm. usually how it starts.
Okay. So just for me to get things clear in my head, mm-hmm. What I can imagine in a very straightforward way would be to have a moderately complex GraphQL schema and then just map that to some one existing database, right? I have this whatever SQL data store or whatever, or maybe no SQL data store, and then I get an incoming, or I need to implement the resolvers for the fields and entities and relationships, and I simply map them to the appropriate queries to my data store.
Yes, you can basically even see it even beyond of that. So you can even So let's say if you have APIs that are specialized for particular things. So you have one API that optimized for doing fuzzy searching on some of the data. And that API just comes back with the hypermedia references, or basically in the end, the IDs for the resource themselves. And GraphQL basically basically combining these resolvers for the IDs and then using then the resolvers for the objects that are sitting behind the IDs, the client wouldn't need to look at the hypermedia reference themselves. They would just fetch the field as of the search result as coming back. And this way, basically, they can really simplify the approach that they're using. That usually is more complicated when backend engineers are providing them
Okay.
with different APIs.
Okay. So that would have been my next question, but it's perfectly fine. You've answered it. How would I go about aggregating data from different sources, right? That's a good example. I get a search index somewhere. I get to perform a search, get some result. There are some IDs. I pick some data from somewhere else, combine them so that they conform to the schema, return that to the client. I
Correct.
completely understand that.
You get probably as well a clear contract that of the data. So otherwise you basically so in the moment you're defining the types for your schema, and you can do unions of them and so on. But in the end, you have specifying a contract, and this allows you basically to do contract basically to validation during the query time, which is quite a difference to usually because in this moment we're speaking still at the moment when front-end developers are maintaining that, so they can ensure the thing that they are expecting from the REST APIs is not diverging over time.
Okay, understood. If I were to implement a, REST API in my terminology, I would basically do the same thing. It would just be maybe in a maybe an implementation to some ad hoc specification or some ad hoc format would basically be the same thing. I would implement the same backend interactions, right, with existing systems, and then return an aggregated result as well. But I would have to come up with a data format and a way to represent that stuff because I don't have the standardization provided by the GraphQL schema.
Correct.
But it's the same layer in that regard. How about if I have some sort of business logic? Is business logic commonly implemented in that GraphQL layer? And if so, how?
Potentially, yes. So in theory, you can build business logic in each of the resolvers for each field, in theory. By experience of the thing that I've seen, usually the logic moves into the mutation and the query becomes more basically simplified. So similar to what you would expect on TQRS. That's what I see, even if it would be possible to add more logic into that. But speaking with that is obviously the next step. Usually what happens of not just paginating simple data would be to say then, can we model the data in a graph? Can we model the list that we are getting as adjacency lists? And that is the big difference after the first step of just using it as a smart proxy. Because then you would say, I don't want to just have a list of appointments, but you would navigate the graph. You would say, I want to go to this patient. I want from this patient all the appointments, and that would be an adjacency list. That would be a list of all the appointments referencing that patient. And suddenly you are navigating your entities and the references, and you are navigating the adjacency list of that graph. That's where the
Sounds as
graph
if
part
you've,
comes into it.
right. It sounds as if somebody's just invented hypermedia, which is awesome. I like that. Very positive development. I'm happy about that.
Yeah, but
Okay,
think of
so.
also, let's say of a web page. So in the web page itself, at the moment, you can only have the links to the other pages. But you don't, if you have a page, you don't get a list of all the pages pointing to you. And that's usually where the pagination usually comes in.
Okay.
And that's so if you have an
But
if
that
you have
is.
a patient, you would say like, what are the appointment pages pointing to this patient? And that would be slightly different to the classical web basically functionality that you would think.
But is that something that I do on the client or on the server side?
On the server side.
Well, but you would implement
the adjacency list. Mm-hmm.
Right. You just have a convenient way to get that, right? Because if this, mm-hmm. you have the schema, you know about this relationship in this direction, you know that a patient has an appointments. Mm-hmm. So your schema allows your environment, your infrastructure to give you a very easy way to get to that thing. But in the end, what you return to the client is the same thing that I would return to the client.
Correct. In a defined or best practice way. So
Yes, mm-hmm. I buy the standardization argument mm-hmm. with all the benefits and downsides that come with that kind of thing. Obviously, but it's perfectly fine. So, so I think I also got a new epiphany when you mentioned the CQRS thing again. So maybe for our listeners who don't know the acronym, CQRS is Command Query Responsibility Segregation, essentially separating the writing, the transactional part, the changing part from the reading part. The reading part would then be very optimized, well, for reading, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that you just explained to me. So I'm rephrasing it in my words, and you can tell mm-hmm. me whether I understood it correctly. Mm-hmm. What you said was that essentially the way you end up with the schemas you end up with in a good GraphQL design basically mm-hmm. allow or design the schema in such a way that it's good for reading, which makes perfect sense.
Correct.
So it's sort of, it's optimized for consumption for just read purposes. And then the writing part is sort of a different channel into the same thing.
Correct.
And then mm-hmm. that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Okay. So it essentially standardizes that as well. Very good. What else? Well, the business logic question, I think we're addressing that, right? You mentioned that the business logic, and that makes perfect sense then, does not belong in the reading part, right? Because you would sort of or denormalize things when you handle the mutation things, mm-hmm. right? You handle the mutation so that the reading then becomes easy and fast or based on the
correct.
Spread out data. So how do you implement the mutating actions on the server side?
Most of the time you're using APIs that are available already in the company. Mm-hmm. There are obviously now already. And that's the part where you usually would write code on the mutations and the resolvers for the fields, where you would put the logic into the mutation. I just want to clarify, you could write business logic in the resolvers of the queries, but it's less common.
So the resolvers of the queries,
they could have code as well in business logic theory.
But if you use the term query here, are you just talking about the reading queries, or do you call the mutation actions queries as well?
Queries is one thing. Mutation is the exactly.
Okay.
So the command side is the mutation, and the query part is the query part of the CQRS.
That makes sense. So I'm not sure you answered my question. I understood that mm-hmm. there is not supposed to be business logic in the queries, mm-hmm. in the reading part. That was the CQRS discussion we just had, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what about the my assumption is if I have some sort of GraphQL server or mm-hmm. framework or whatever they're called, then I have maybe some kind of hook that I can use to implement some logic that runs when a mutation happens, right?
Yeah, the resolvers and the mutation side. Mm-hmm.
So on the mutation side, they're also called resolvers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I wasn't sure of that. Okay.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is in theory, I could write business logic in the resolvers. In practice, I would essentially most of the time end up delegating to some other system.
Yes, very often it goes to APIs that exist.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the APIs are already having sometimes event-driven architecture already in place, which fits nicely to that. So if the APIs already have that, on the same time, you have situations where mutations and query goes still to the same database.
Okay. So let me play my... Let me play my curmudgeon role here again.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like a super sophisticated, fancy solution to a problem that I'd rather not have. Because what we have is we have backend APIs that aren't great, and then we put this complicated server-side infrastructure on top of that to turn them into something that is okay, so that we have a client that can consume that stuff that is now standardized and okay to build something on the client side mm-hmm. that I would the very beginning have built on the server side in
correct.
The first application layer that doesn't correct. Suck. So yes. that is sort of, that's sort of an architectural
it's,
thing.
It's,
so
it's little... exactly what happens on the corporation. So
yeah.
usually you have this situation where the front end really says, actually backend, you are not doing what the customer actually wants. It's not the exact thing that I need. We build a, let's say, a highly sophisticated GraphQL service in front of it. And we are doing that at that point. And in the meantime, the backend continues to do their work and just ignoring what the frontend does, because they will build their GraphQL, and they're adding more and more endpoints to their API gateway or to their mesh, and they're adding more and more microservices. So we are basically probably on the, what are the optimized numbers of microservices? So you're probably on the 400 something. And then the point of the situation where the frontend says, actually, we can't cope anymore to write resolvers up to the field level for probably 400 endpoints, and we have to maintain all in one big schema, it gets out of hand. And they're basically throwing the toys out of the pram. That's usually what happens in that situation.
Big sigh. But okay, let's move on. One thing that I was wondering about, and I think you mentioned it in passing before, obviously this will at some point in time become unmanageable on the GraphQL server side as well, right? So how can you turn that into something more manageable when you need to scale it to a bigger schemas?
So the interesting part is a lot of the front-end developers that got to that point, so it happened to me before at The Economist, where, as we were doing that there with microservices, where the front-end was saying it became like a monolith. Where the whole corporation data model is in one schema, and all the translation for all the APIs is in one place, and it feels like a monolith. And then you have this transition where the front end says, actually, can you that you are building the APIs actually look at what we build and basically follow our path and take care of your small bits? And then the backend says, actually, we are not looking at such a big domain. We are only working smaller teams. We are only taking care of smaller microservices. We are not taking care of the whole thing. Nobody wants to be responsible on the backend. And that was a classical problem that a lot of companies went into with GraphQL. That's why probably a year ago, roughly, there was several... At some point, people were coming up with, can we stitch GraphQL queries together so that different backend teams can take a part of it? Mm-hmm. But that didn't really work out. And then Apollo came up with a new standardization called Apollo Federation, but it's not specific to Apollo, where you specify a very lightweight gateway that inspects the data schemas of different domain gateways that basically are added to the federation, and basically looks them up every time basically something's changed in any of the upstream gateways, domain gateways, and looks at the definitions of them, looks at foreign references to the other domain gateways, and builds up a federated domain gateway across the company, while everyone else just provides a small subset of their domain into the federation. Basically, the next iteration, which you would basically call the clean API gateway on the REST side, this basically is the part where the pain of the front end of dealing with a lot of microservices being available and dealing with a common data model that you have across them to split the responsibility up, and where you then have the situation where you have a little bit like a shared data model between the front end and the back end. But the backend is then responsible for their entities with the normalization on the data model so that you would reference to the other one. And GraphQL itself is more like a query optimizer. So in the moment you are asking for some data, it basically has the information about the data models coming from the different domain gateways. You know where the data is sitting, which format it has, and optimizes the queries across the different domains for the queries coming in. And that's at the moment the new state of the art.
I don't know.
Can you hear sighing? Yes.
It's. You know, there was a time when I would have been really happy to hear all this, because I can basically, you know, my old mind can basically hear all the consulting revenue coming in. There is so much to, you know, there's so much to talk about and teach people, and there's so much to coach people. Oh, it's fantastic. I can see how some people might be really big fans of this approach. It's really, you know, it's a bit like, it reminds me a bit of the soap whistle WS Death Star world mm-hmm. that I used to be a part of. So I'm guilty of that as well. I'm not, you know, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. I was just as guilty of this as well. I've stopped believing in that. It's just all this complication, all these layers, all this complexity. I mean, things could be simpler, right? It would be better if they were simpler, because they would be more manageable, and they would be, you could better understand them, and you could better maintain them, and you could actually have something that moves faster, and, you know, has more value for less of an investment. So
I think the interesting part is,
but maybe that battle is lost. I don't know.
So let's put it this way: it's not too complicated, okay? And you can see that because it was GraphQL was initially introduced in a lot of the companies to simplify the work with the REST APIs and having a clear data structure. So the approach there is still very data driven and simplification driven for the front end. It's very lightweight still. So the federation, I think, he tries to get this several domain that we have and tries to normalize it as much as possible. But you are moving complexity in the architecture. So what you would have in your REST API, where you would call out to other services or you would subscribe to other services to get the data, that complexity moves into your data schema. You end up to define the schema to say, I have an appointment, but this appointment needs a patient, a practitioner location, and I leave it to the other three domain gateways to provide us this data and the schemas for them. And it's basically, it's moving responsibility and delegating responsibility away. And it's probably more solving an organizational thing. And at the same time, moving responsibility away from the team, so they don't have to call out and fetch data and understand the data themselves.
This all makes perfect sense. So I think there are certain use cases where this matches perfectly, right? So I'm not debating whether that is the case or not. It's just more of a discussion whether you want to be in a situation where you need something like that, and maybe you can't avoid being in that situation. And if you can't, or if some other circumstances force you to deal with it with that kind of that kind of scenario, then that seems like a very well thought out attempt, and which is probably evidenced by its popularity. I mean, there are always some good ideas in every approach, right? Otherwise, it would simply disappear into darkness somewhere. But it this is definitely a very interesting thing. So I've learned a lot about where a GraphQL might be applicable. Can't say it has fundamentally changed my opinion, but I understand it a lot better, and I have now in my mind a certain scenario of use cases where I could imagine GraphQL could be a very good match. Mm-hmm. Are there some additional use cases that you want to mention where GraphQL is a particularly good fit?
I think the interesting part there is a little bit as well the discussion about ownership of domains and how the domains relate to each other. Because in the moment, especially if you're going to the part of the federation where you specify what you own and you reference it, or you delegate the definition of other values to the others, at that moment you have to figure out who owns which domain and how the relationship are to each other. And this conversation is forced in that moment where in a classical API gateway, people, the only thing they're interested in is that you don't have colliding endpoints on the API gateway. And probably there is probably even less of conversation if you just have a mesh. And I think the interesting part is more like, what does it support? And it supports a conversation about the data model consistency, where are the boundaries of the domains, how are they relating to each other, and so on, which in the moment, basically everyone in the company is contributing to it. Basically, you have to have a much more conscious discussion about that. And it's enabling this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't solve it, obviously, because you can still mess it up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I will refrain from comparisons to canonical data models and enterprise-wide data models. I will just not mention it. That's my new strategy. Not mentioning it by mentioning it. So that's Arthur, this was extremely interesting. Thanks a lot for all the information. As usual, my last question is, do you have some resources that you want to point our listeners to?
Yes. I think there are several interesting talks. I think Apollo has a few ones about how they're being used. There are some other talks about different companies that are explaining how they implemented GraphQL or even implemented Federation. And we'll provide the links in the show notes.
Perfect. So the show notes are going to be awesome. lots of links provided by Arthur. So it's all based on his input. Listeners, thank you so much for listening. Arthur, thank you so much for being with us here today.
Thank you so much.
Have fun, everyone, and make wise choices in terms of the architecture.
Okay. Always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.